From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
You can't spoil a political system that's spoiled to the core. We need a new political reform movement in this country. It's not going to come from the Democratic or Republican parties.
As John Kerry names John Edwards as his running mate, the runoff for president is set. Four candidates who supported the war in Iraq will speak with independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who's just released a new book called The Good Fight. We'll get his response to being kicked off the ballot in Arizona, why he isn't running as a Green Party candidate, and charges that his candidacy will help George Bush win re-election. And a Kentucky newspaper apologizes for whiting out the civil rights movement.
40 years after the civil rights movement, the Lexington Herald leader tried to set the record straight and explain why the stories hadn't been in the paper in the first place.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq's unelected prime minister has been given the right to declare martial law and personally take control of much of the government in times of crisis. Iraq's interim government approved the new national security law earlier today. Iyad Alawi, former Ba'athist with ties to the CIA, will be given the power to take control of the military, police, and intelligence units. He'll be able to institute curfews, ban public demonstrations, conduct emergency searches of private property, and order the army to fight the Iraqi resistance. He'll also be allowed to ban groups he deems to be seditious. Alawi has sought even greater powers, but will be forced to gain support from within his government before declaring emergency law. In addition, Alawi is expected to announce as early as today a plan to offer amnesty to members of the Iraqi resistance. On the campaign trail, Senator John Edwards has joined Senator John Kerry on a four-day tour through Ohio, Florida, West Virginia, and New Mexico. Edwards' selection as a running mate for Kerry is not sitting well with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Even before he was selected, the business group announced if he were chosen, the Chamber of Commerce would abandon its traditional stance of neutrality in an effort to defeat the Democratic ticket. This according to the Wall Street Journal. One anonymous Fortune 100 CEO called Edwards, quote, the one we fear the most because he's a trial lawyer. The Miami Herald's determined that at least 2,100 people, many of them African-American Democrats, are wrongly included in a list of felons who may not be able to vote in November in Florida. The Miami Herald reviewed the names on a state list of voters to purge and found 2,100 of them had been granted clemency and therefore had the right to vote. The American Civil Liberties Union has announced it'll sue the state to remove the names of any voters with clemency from the state databases. In Washington, a federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit filed by FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, filed against the Justice Department before he even heard evidence in the case. The judge, who admitted his decision is draconian, ruled a trial might expose government secrets that could damage national security. In her suit, Edmonds charges she was wrongly fired in March 2002 after she complained there were major problems within the FBI translation unit. Edmonds speaks Turkish and Farsi. She was hired after the September 11th attacks to translate intelligence related to Al-Qaeda gathered over the previous year. Edmonds has since told the press the FBI had evidence before 9/11 that indicated an attack using airplanes was imminent. Edmonds' attorney, Mark Zaid, said, quote, the decision today represents another example of the executive branch's abusive nature of using secrecy as a weapon against whistleblowers. It's quite disappointingly evident that accountability is no longer a word in our government's dictionary, he said. NBC News is now reporting that former Navy Secretary John Layman, who's now serving on the 9/11 Commission, has become the lead contender to replace George Tenet as Director of Central Intelligence. He served as Secretary to the Navy under President Reagan. Layman is a longtime critic of the CIA and has close ties to neoconservatives in Washington. His brother, Chris Layman, served in the Office of Special Plans, the Pentagon Special Intelligence Unit that was set up to help make the case for the Iraq invasion. In Gaza, the Red Cross has begun distributing food and medicine to hundreds of Palestinians who've been trapped in the town of Beit Hanun for a week. Since the Israeli army took over the town last week, Palestinians report more than half of the farmland in the area has been destroyed, including thousands of orange and lemon trees. Israel entered the area after Palestinians launched a fatal rocket attack on southern Israel. Former U.S. paratrooper Jeremy Hinsman will ask Canadian officials for asylum today. Hinsman is one of at least three known U.S. Army deserters who refused to fight in Iraq and are now seeking refugee status in Canada. The 25-year-old is living in Toronto with his wife and two-year-old son. Hinsman will likely be asked to prove, like other refugee applicants, that he has a reason to believe he would be persecuted if he returned home. Supporters of Hinsman point to the case of Sergeant Camilla Mejia, who was sentenced to a year in prison for deserting his unit in Iraq. Hinsman says he's received many threatening emails, mostly from Americans, which he hopes will strengthen his case for asylum. Despite wide opposition from Democrats and groups like Planned Parenthood, the Senate confirmed James Leon Holmes to the U.S. District Court in Arkansas yesterday in a vote 51-46. The vote followed debate over Holmes' position on abortion, women's rights, race, and separation of church and state. He's written that the role of, quote, the wife is to subordinate herself to her husband, compared pro-choice activists to Nazis, said that rape victims don't often get pregnant, and compared abortion to slavery. The Inspector General's Office of the Health and Human Services Department concluded yesterday the Bush administration officials did not violate the law when they withheld information about the high costs of the planned Medicare overhaul last year. Congress passed the administration's Medicare bill based on an estimated cost of about $400 billion. In January, Bush announced the overhaul would actually cost $534 billion over 10 years. Democratic lawmakers initiated an investigation when the HHS chief actuary, Richard Foster, announced in March that top administrator Tom Scully had threatened to fire him if he released the information to legislators during the congressional debate. Bush's plan overhauled the health care program for 41 million senior and disabled beneficiaries by increasing the role of private insurance companies, health maintenance organizations, and drug benefit managers. A Texas couple was charged with trespassing on the 4th of July for wearing anti-Bush T-shirts at a speech given by the president in West Virginia. Although the couple, Nicole and Jeffrey Rank, had tickets to the event, security insisted they leave or stand in a designated protest zone. When they refused, police detained them. From the stage, President Bush said, quote, "We're thankful that this nation they created 228 years ago remains free and independent and the best hope for all mankind." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As John Kerry names John Edwards as his running mate, the runoff for president is set. Four candidates who support the war in Iraq. Today we're going to speak with independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. He's just released a new book called The Good Fight. We'll get his reaction to being kicked off the ballot in Arizona, why he isn't running as a Green Party candidate, and to charges that he will help President Bush win re-election. But I want to start with your reaction to the choice of John Edwards. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Good morning, Amy. I think it was, from John Kerry's point of view, probably the most effective choice. John Edwards has been vetted. There aren't going to be any skeletons in his closet. He's got a good To America speech. There'll be a lot of dynamism, and he's a charmer. But the question I have is, will he defend the civil justice system, which is the right of the American people when they're wrongfully injured or defrauded to have their full day in court against corporations, or will he sidestep that issue? The civil justice system is under serious attack. It's already been eroded in state legislatures, and there's a current class action bill in the Congress that will further weaken the rights of defrauded people from having their day in state court. So that remains to be seen.
You have written about, or actually have also spoken to John Kerry. What did you say to John Kerry when you spoke to him? Did you urge him to choose John Edwards?
I wrote him a letter a few weeks ago urging him, and made it public on our website, votenader.org, which, by the way, demonstrates the wide differences in the agenda of the Nader-Peter Camejo ticket compared to the other two parties, where the other two parties are pro-war, pro-Patriot Act, pro-death penalty, pro-corporate globalization, and we are on the other side of that. We're the only anti-war candidate. So when I talked to John Kerry, I talked basically about the dirty tricks that the Democratic parties at the state level are using to try to keep us off the ballot on technicalities, drain our resources. In Arizona, the Democrats hired three corporate law firms. They filed suit against us on such things as one of our signature gatherers takes about 14,500 signatures to get on the Arizona ballot. One of our signature gatherers collected 550 signatures. He happened to be an ex-felon who had paid his debt to society. He'd been on juries. He was a registered voter. They found that he did not pay, allegedly, a $400 fine to the state, and they wanted to knock off 550 signatures. And that would have cost us long days in litigation, and we had to drop our effort. We have limited funds under Federal Election Commission regulation. The Democrats have unlimited funds outside of any regulation. And that's what they're doing in Oregon and elsewhere. And I told John Kerry, words to the wise, he may be presiding over a situation, whether he knows it or not, that can be a mini Watergate.
There's a piece CNN did a few days ago saying efforts by two conservative groups to help President Bush by getting independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader on the ballot in key battleground state of Oregon has prompted a complaint to the Federal Election Commission by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, known as CREW, which said phone banks encouraging Bush supporters to attend a Nader nominating convention amounted to an illegal in-kind contribution to your campaign by the Oregon Family Council and Oregon Citizens for a Sound Economy, two conservative groups. Your response?
Well, this group should be called Citizens for Irresponsibility. They filed these complaints based on newspaper clippings. There's no coordination at all with the Republicans. We had no evidence in our convention in a high school auditorium in Portland, Oregon, the other day, that they were in any way supporting us. We did have evidence that the Democrats had infiltrated the auditorium to swell our number above the required 1,000 supporters, and as a result, gave us the impression
And the impression also was conveyed to Oregon state election authorities who were there with their counters that we could close the doors and start the balloting. And then when the doors were closed and some latecomers were left out, the 100 or so Democrats refused to sign the nomination forms. So they were like Trojan horses. So the Democrats did obstruct. The Republicans put out press releases but didn't engage in any results. But I think the Committee on So-Called Responsibility, that is going to be coming under a strong scrutiny because they're engaging in reckless harassment.
And then there's this piece in the Boston Globe that says billionaire Richard Egan built his reputation in politics as a major donor and fundraiser for the Bush campaign, steering hundreds of thousands of dollars into Republican coffers in recent years. But now it appears Egan and his relatives are bankrolling a new candidate, independent presidential contender Ralph Nader, and says he co-founded EMC Corporation in Hopkinton, has given you the maximum $2,000 allowed under the law. According to federal elections, documents also show a $4,000 contribution to you from Egan's son and daughter-in-law. An independent campaign finance watch group lists the Egan-managed capital company, another family business in Massachusetts, as among the biggest contributors to the Nader campaign.
Well, we welcome all contributions that are lawful and from American citizens. I don't know the Egans. I know that John Kerry wanted to appoint Republican Senator John McCain, who is a pro-war senator, to become his vice president. I know John Kerry said he wants Republican votes. And you can bet that the fat cats are bankrolling each other's parties to hedge their bets. Republican fat cats contribute to Democrats. Democratic rich fat cats contribute to Republicans. But there's no sign that they are any coordinated contributions from the Republicans. We've raised over $1 million, much over our website, votenader.org, and I would be very surprised if there was very much from Republicans, number one. And number two, the ones that have come in that I've recognized, Bob Monks is my classmate at Harvard Law School. He is a corporate governance expert, and I've worked with him, and he contributed. And Gino Pellucci, we worked on the Mesabi Iron Range pollution many years ago in Minnesota, and he contributed. So we welcome all contributions from listeners because we're not taking any commercial money. We don't take any PAC money. We only take individual contributions either through the mail or through the website votenader.org.
Ralph Nader, do you find the opposition right now to you fiercer than you've ever experienced in your presidential runs?
Yes. It's expected. I like a robust debate. Peter Camejo, he's very used to robust debate and action. He marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama, and he's been active ever since, and he's the first Latino vice presidential candidate. And it's about time that 39 million Latinos had someone who could address their concerns, speak fluent Spanish, and represents the defense of all minorities. We're used to that. What is unfortunate and dismaying is the political bigotry that is being demonstrated by some liberals. Sure, oppose us, challenge us, argue with us, but don't say, you can speak, assemble, and petition outside the electoral arena, but don't go into the electoral arena and be so adamant about it. And, of course, the Democrats' dirty tricks are just beginning to unfold, and I'm sure the press will report more of what's going on there. But we have an obligation to challenge the two-party cabal, the one corporate party with two heads wearing different makeup, the kind of parties that have brought us corporate occupied territory in Washington, the kind of parties that have let giant business say no to health insurance for everybody, no to living wage, no to a fair tax system, no to waging peace, no to doing something about the bloated, wasteful Pentagon budget that now comprises one half of the federal government's operating expenditures at the expense of schools, clinics, public transit systems, and all the necessities back home that don't find any funds to improve facilities for the American people.
Ralph Nader, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll come back. And we'll talk about what happened at the Green Party convention and also your new book, The Good Fight, and then ask about your plans for the convention. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Our guest right now is independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. He also has written a book called The Good Fight, Declare Your Independence and Close the Democracy Gap. What about what happened at the Green Party in Milwaukee? You wanted their endorsement. You announced right before the convention that Peter Camejo would be your running mate. Well-known Green Party activist and candidate in California, very respected in the Green Party. In the end, they chose David Cobb, another of the presidential candidates. Your response?
I wasn't contesting the nomination. I took myself out of the nomination for the Green Party in December. But then I was asked again and again by many Greens around the country, well, since the Greens are split, some of them don't want any presidential candidate this year because they want to beat Bush. Would I accept an endorsement if at their convention they decided not to nominate anybody? And I said, all right, fine. Instead, they did nominate somebody. So they made the decision, and fine, I wish them good luck. I don't talk about this in the book, The Good Fight. This book is really not a campaign book as much as a book designed to motivate citizens to see how they're being controlled and how they can fight back to reassert the sovereignty of the people. And what's interesting, I ran across a Business Week poll a while back before the most recent corporate crime wave that's drained trillions of dollars from innocent people, pension holders and workers. And 72% of the American people said that corporations had too much control over their lives. And that's what this book is about, how corporations control our lives and how we can mobilize to do something about it.
Do you feel like what you've been dealing with for 40 years, the power of corporations, is finally gaining currency? I mean, now popularly, you know, you have the corporation, the film, this poll, what you're citing, almost three quarters of the American people across the political spectrum are deeply concerned about corporate control. Can you talk about, and you mention it in the book, how you did get started, what first ignited you?
Well, I have a lot of personal stories in the book, and one of them was I hitchhiked a lot as a student all over the country, tens of thousands of miles, and I'd come across crashes often, you know, with the truck driver, whoever picked me up, before the police got there, and really it was a horrible scene of carnage. And I began to notice the way the cars crumpled. The steering column would ram back into the space where the driver was like a spear. People would be spilled out on the highway because the doors would pop open too readily. People would split their skulls on sharp edge dash panels. And so I wrote a book called Unsafe at Any Speed. In 1965, General Motors hired private detectives to try to get some dirt on me. Members of Congress investigating this caught them. There's a celebrated congressional committee. General Motors admitted in open congressional session for all the press that they did this. That provided the momentum for the first historic regulation by the federal government of the auto industry, requiring life-saving standards to be installed, like seat belts and later airbags and padded dash panels and collapsing steering columns and better braking systems. And that has saved over a million American lives, many more lives abroad, because the foreign manufacturers had to meet the same standards to enter the U.S. market, and millions of injuries reduced or prevented. That really taught me just how far these corporate executives would go out of their way, knowing that their engineers knew how to save hundreds of thousands of casualties a year, but they still wanted to sell cars for horsepower and style rather than for safety. Now they're advertising safety, Amy, on the TV. They're bragging about the very things they fought us tooth and nail on years ago. So I talk about some of these stories, Allegheny Airlines, how we caught them overbooking passengers, went to the Supreme Court, and now when people go to airports and there's an overbooking situation, they auction the seats, as everybody knows. They have a PA announcement, and the flight attendant says, we've been overbooked. Anybody wants to give up a seat, they'll get $200-$300 plus a ticket on the next flight to your destination. So we try to give people civic motivation. We have a lot of fun things in the book, 10 simple ways to shaft yourself as a consumer. Buy before you think, buy before you read, buy before you ask questions, buy before you can afford to buy before you comparison shop, buy when you're tired or hungry, buy when you're rushed, buy when your child demands the product, buy to keep up with your friends and neighbors. There's some humor, and it makes people indignant, and that's what we want. We want people to say, I'm damn mad, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And at the end of the book, we have standards for becoming a super voter and not be fooled, flattered, and flummoxed. And by the way, this book, I think, is going to be a bestseller. It's moving up fast on the Amazon scale. This is the first day it was published, and it's up to 216 on the Amazon scale. So we think this is going to be a motivating book. It's a short book. It's a clear book. It's got lots of examples, and it's got some interesting disclosures, like how the two parties take campaign contributions in recent years from corporate criminals. They wouldn't take these contributions from regular individual criminals, but they take them from ADM and Warner Lambert and others who have been convicted or pled guilty to criminal violations, and then they turn around and give $1 million here, $2 million there to the Democrat Republican Party. There seems to be no sanction on that, and we should not distinguish between corporate criminals and let them give money to political parties, and then say, oh, it's terrible for regular criminals to do so.
You talk about Microsoft, you talk about McDonald's.
Yes. Yes, well, McDonald's is a fat and sugar pump. It is under pressure, of course. That new film is going to help. That fellow who ate nothing but McDonald's food for months and what happened to him physically. But McDonald's is a company over the years has marketed directly to children, separating them from their parents with these slogans, it's a child's world, to get the children to nag the parents to go to McDonald's. And they get a lot of fat, and they get a lot of sugar, and children's obesity is skyrocketing, along with diabetes. And it's a very unhealthy diet. McDonald's now is beginning to feel the heat and starting to offer salads, for example. But by and large, they've done a lot of damage, along with other fast food corporations. Microsoft is a monopoly's been deemed as such by the courts when the Justice Department went after it. It's a monopoly in the operating system, and it proceeds to use that monopoly to attach applications that then become monopolies down the line, and that has retarded innovation and raised prices unnecessarily to consumers. And it doesn't seem to be anything except perhaps the European Common Market prosecutors who can do anything. The case has been completed, and Microsoft is still a monopoly. It's generating over $1 billion in pure cash every month. It has the biggest cash hoard in world history, $62 billion. It illustrates the weakness of the antitrust laws.
Yet it still gets tax credits.
Yes, it gets tax credits. Imagine, in effect, the Treasury Department is writing a check every year to Microsoft. I mean, it's really crazy what's going on. Microsoft and General Electric own MSNBC. When they started MSNBC, they said there were going to be 300 workers, and will it be in New York City or New Jersey? And they dangled it in front of the mayor and in front of Governor Whitman, and Governor Whitman won the deal, among others, providing a whole collage of freebies to the two richest corporations in the world. And one of them was, check this, that the workers in MSNBC who have to pay state income taxes, those taxes are then refunded back to Microsoft and General Electric as part of the deal of locating MSNBC in New Jersey. Corporate welfare is draining hundreds of billions of dollars, local, state, and national, away from the treasuries and making the taxpayer pay for stadiums and ballparks and so on instead of repairing schools and clinics. And it's not even a political issue in this campaign. The Nader-Kamejo candidacy will make it a political issue.
We're talking to independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who has written a new book that has just been published this week, The Good Fight, Declare Your Independence and Close the Democracy Gap. I wanted to ask you about comments of the head of the Anti-Defamation League objecting to what you have said about the White House and Congress. You were speaking to a gathering of Muslim activists on Capitol Hill at a hearing entitled The Muslim Vote in Election 2004, said, I don't think there's any prospect of the two parties differing in any significant way on the Middle East. The Israeli puppeteer travels to Washington, meets with the puppet in the White House. He then goes down to Pennsylvania Avenue and meets with the puppets in Congress. The Israeli leader then, quote, brings back millions of dollars in aid to Israel. It's time for the United States government to stand up and think for itself, you said. ADL National, Abraham Foxman, the ADL National Director, said, we write to object to your characterization of the White House and Congress as puppets of the Israeli government. Reasonable people can and do disagree with U.S. policy related to Middle East, specifically U.S. support for Israel. However, there's a line between thoughtful reason, constructive disagreements, and offensive hyperbole. Your response?
Well, I've said that on more than one occasion. In Washington, it's the old Roman saying, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. Of course they're puppets. They pass these resolutions with over 400 members of Congress because the AIPAC wants them to. There's no independent thinking there. But in response to Mr. Foxman, I'll quote him, Tom Friedman, on the February 5th column in the New York Times, when he said the following. This is Thomas Friedman, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of books on the Middle East. Quote, Mr. Sharon has the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat under house arrest in his office in Ramallah, and he's had George Bush under house arrest in the Oval Office. Mr. Sharon has Mr. Arafat surrounded by tanks, and Mr. Bush surrounded by Jewish and Christian pro-Israeli lobbyists, by a Vice President Dick Cheney, who is ready to do whatever Mr. Sharon dictates, and by political handlers telling the President not to put any pressure on Israel in an election year, all conspiring to make sure the President does nothing. That's end quote. Those are the words of Thomas Friedman. So maybe Mr. Foxman wants to take it up with Thomas Friedman. The truth here is that there's no balanced determination. The U.S. government never connects with the deep and broad Israeli peace movement that represents members and former members of the Knesset, former military people, former intelligence people, former mayors, existing mayors, professors, rabbis. They put 120,000 people in a square in Tel Aviv recently. You would think that if the U.S. government was not a puppet, it would support the deep Israeli peace movement, which has been in touch with the Palestinian peace advocates and has worked out more than one accord where there can be a two-state solution living in peace with a viable, independent Palestinian state. So there should be a debate. The two candidates, Kerry and Bush, are both pro-Israeli military government. They do not connect with the Israeli peace movement or Peace Now or Jewish Voice for Peace or Michael Lerner's Tikkun Group. Both Kerry and Bush are pro-war. Our candidacy with Peter Kamejo is the only anti-war candidacy. We have a proposal to engage in a responsible six-month withdrawal from Iraq, pulling out our military and corporate occupation of that country, having internationally supervised elections so there's no puppet government. And those policies will separate the mainstream Iraqis from supporting or sympathizing with the insurgency, which is spreading. That's the only way to do it. You do not say to the mainstream Iraqis that they're going to be faced with an endless, if not permanent, military and corporate occupation by the U.S. with a puppet regime and get peace and stability in that war-torn nation.
Ralph Nader, the Boston Globe is reporting Senator John Kerry has released a new policy paper on Israel in which he fully supports Israel's construction of the 425-mile wall through the West Bank. Last year, Senator Kerry said the wall was a barrier to peace. But in the new policy paper, Kerry writes, "The security fence is a legitimate act of self-defense. The title of the paper is Strengthening Israel's Security and Bolstering the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. In one part of the paper, Kerry concludes, Israel's cause must be America's cause. Your response?
Well, that's an example of a puppet politician who does not think in the best interests of the American people and the Israeli and Palestinian people, majority of people in Israel, and a majority of Americans of Jewish faith in this country support an independent Palestinian state as a solution, peaceful solution to that long drawn out conflict. It's really interesting. John Kerry on the wall is now not even up to the Israeli Supreme Court, which has issued a decision quite critical of the way the wall is being built to take existing Palestinian land, separate peasants from their farms or children from their schools. So he ought to read the latest decision by the Israeli Supreme Court.
The Hague will be ruling on this on Friday. I wanted to go for a minute back to the year 2000, to the Republican convention.
Closer to the podium of the Republican National Convention. We'll see if we get in here.
I see a lot of purple.
Sorry, some states you're drawing at 7 or 8%. Do you think, would you be the spoiler if this race is close?
You can't spoil a political system that's spoiled to the core. We need a new political reform movement in this country. It's not going to come from the Democratic or Republican parties.
So, Ralph Nader, you were just on the convention floor of the Republican National Convention. Cheney is going to be speaking. George Bush is being nominated tonight. What are your comments on George W. Bush of Texas?
I think he's a conglomerate corporation running for president disguised as a person. I don't think there's ever been a candidate since McKinley who represents big business so faithfully and tries to manipulate images in order to appear like he's for the people.
Ralph Nader, tonight you have gone onto the convention floor. Dick Cheney is now speaking, the vice presidential nominee and CEO of Halliburton, the largest oil service company in the world, also former minister, also former Secretary of Defense. What about that combination of military and corporation?
Well, I think he's going to represent big business. He comes from big business. He just displayed some of the fork-tongue rhetoric of the Republicans by saying quote, no more shirking our duties to the elderly, end quote. Does that mean he's going to have tough government Medicare negotiations to bring down drug prices? Is he going to protect Social Security, or is he going to turn the billions of Social Security over to Wall Street firms, or big supporters of the Republican Party, to invest in and destabilize Social Security? Is he going to protect elderly people from all these consumer scams? So you see, it's just rhetoric. You know, they're telling people what people want to hear, but they're not giving people what people want them to deliver. And that's a forked-tongue politics based on cash register symbiosis with big business interests.
That was Ralph Nader when we went together to the floor of the Republican convention in the year 2000.
One of your finest moments, Amy.
Very interesting response you got from Republicans then. Now it's 4 years later, last night on Jon Stewart's show, when asked, you know, what do you think of Bush and Kerry? And you did repeat, you know, well, of course, anything but Bush. But what about that philosophy? And as you describe what the Democrats have done to you in terms of pushing you off the ballot as perhaps a scandal greater than Watergate, where do you stand exactly here?
I said it might be a mini Watergate, but where I stand is simple. The two parties are being pulled 24 hours a day by a whole variety of intense corporate interests into the maw of their lobbying power, into the maw of corporate globalization. Who's pulling on the other side? That's what our Nader-Kamejo candidacy is about. If we give John Kerry a blank check, he will have no mandates. I have not met any group supporting John Kerry that's demanding anything of John Kerry. And when I met him over a month ago, I said, you know, if you win, you're not going to have any mandate. He said, oh, don't worry, I'll do this and that, and when I'm president. Yeah, we've heard that before. And that's the key here. Who is pulling in the direction of the interests of the American people and their necessities on the Democratic Party if you have an anybody-but-Bush mentality? Anybody-but-Bush closes the mind immediately. There is no room for any variables, strategies, tactics, any innovation in presidential campaigning, and you're signaling to the Democrats that they can take your vote for granted, and when you do that, you're taken. And that's particularly true of labor and minorities, without which the Democrats wouldn't win any elections. They are being taken for granted. They can't even get a living wage for 47 million full-time workers in this country. One out of every three workers is making less than $10 an hour. 25% of the workers are making, in this country, just think of that, are making less than $8.70 an hour gross before deductions and before the cost of driving to work.
Will you remain in the race to the end?
Yes, of course. All the thousands of people who are volunteering for us, who are now, as we speak, getting signatures to get us on the ballot in various states, those people will never be betrayed by the Nader-Kamejo ticket.
How many states are you on the ballot now?
We're just getting underway. The deadlines for 46 states are in July and August, and we expect to be on well over 40 states. We will not be on Oklahoma, and we will not be on Indiana other than write-ins. And the Democrats are challenging us in Texas, where we got over 80,000 signatures. We have a nice constitutional lawsuit that we have filed against the Secretary of State in Texas and federal district court. We're looking for pro bono lawyers. We need them. This is a civil liberties fight, not just for us, but for all third parties and all independent candidates who give more voices and choices to the American people and who are the source historically in the 19th and 20th century of political regeneration. That includes abolition of slavery, women's right to vote, the right of workers to form trade unions, the farmer populist progressive movement. If you marginalize and exclude third parties and independent candidates at the local, state, and national level, you are ossifying an increasingly converging two-party system.
Ralph Nader, last election, Michael Moore supported you. He is definitely throwing his support now, calling for support for the Democrats and throwing out George Bush. Your response?
I don't know what's happened to Michael. I mean, he made a very successful film, and all good luck to him. But, you know, one year he's for this candidate, another year he's for that. He endorsed Wesley Clark in New Hampshire, and then he said something about he wanted to take our votes away, imagine that, to Kerry. And then he says falsely that I promised in 2000 not to campaign in the close states, which is not true. He campaigned with me in the close states right up to 2 days before the election. He was supporting us in the giant MCI Center rally in Washington, D.C. So I don't know where he is politically anymore. I thought more highly of him when he was a challenger, a resistor, when he defied the political system. And he's got to sort out his own political positions more clearly.
The Green Party also chose a candidate who basically is taking that safe state strategy, saying they want to build the Green Party from the grassroots up, but in the swing states, taking a different strategy.
Yeah, well, then you shouldn't have a third party. I mean, the only leverage third parties historically in our country have had on the two parties is when they can deny them votes in close states. I mean, why should Kerry or Bush listen to the Green Party if the Green Party is just going to campaign in safe Republican or safe Democratic state? And the argument I make in this book, The Good Fight, is basically that people have got to understand what corporate control is all about. It's not just something that people feel generally. They've got to understand how they're being controlled as taxpayers, as corporations become tax-free institutions. They've got to understand what corporations are doing to their children and exploiting childhood. It's how they're doing it that motivates people, not just that they are doing it, the environment. We have chapters in all these areas, and we're trying to generate the kind of elan, you know, civic elan, where people can understand the suppressed necessities in our society and the concentration of greed and power, but be motivated to do something about it rather than be demoralized. And that's the purpose of this Good Fight book, and I think it's going to be a bestseller.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you for being with us. Independent presidential candidate now has a new book out. It's called The Good Fight, Declare Your Independence and Close the Democracy Gap. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we go south to a newspaper that is now talking about how it waited out the civil rights movement. Stay with us.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much. Yeah. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail.
Nina Simone here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. On July 4th, the front page article in the Lexington Herald Leader newspaper in Kentucky said, quote, "It's come to the editor's attention that the Herald Leader neglected to cover the civil rights movement. We regret the omission." In a series of articles entitled Front Page News, Back Page Coverage, the Herald Leader issued an apology for failing to adequately cover the civil rights movement for 40 years ago. The correction was run to mark both Independence Day and the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The mea culpa notes the omissions by the city's two newspapers, the Lexington Herald and the Lexington Leader, weren't simply mistakes or oversights. The paper's management actively sought to downplay the movement. As one former Herald editor put it, quote, the management's view was that the less publicity it got, the quicker the problem would go away. The paper's apology says, quote, that the inadequate coverage, quote, hurt the civil rights movement at the time, irreparably damaged the historical record, and caused the newspaper's readers to miss out on one of the most important stories of the 20th century. We're joined now by Linda Blackford, who's a staff writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, who researched and wrote the paper's apology. How did you begin your research, and what was the turning point where the paper, 40 years later, decided to say, mea culpa, we got it wrong?
Well, two things happened. We were doing research for coverage of the 50th anniversary of the Brown v. Board decision, and we couldn't find any stories in the archives about what had happened locally. And about that same time, John Carroll gave a speech at an editor's meeting talking about corrections, and it was sort of joking, but he said, the Herald, you know, we should have run this correction. The Herald Leader neglected to cover the civil rights movement. And our projects editor, a guy named John Voskel, sort of came over and said, what do you think about this? And we just sort of started talking about it. And the story was born. So we started talking to former reporters and former civil rights demonstrators who are still in town. And that's how we got started.
And what does it mean to say you didn't cover it at all?
Well, I think maybe that's a little strong. There was coverage of big marches. There was mostly, it was covered like a police report. It was covered only when people were arrested or when there was some kind of complaint about it. The ideas of why these young people were demonstrating was completely ignored. The sort of larger hopes of this group and what they were trying to change was completely ignored. Everything was geared toward arrests and sort of public unrest.
We're also joined on the line by Calvert McCann, retired social worker, took photographs of the Lexington civil rights activism as a high school student. Were they published at the time?
Were
Calvert McCann, your photographs?
Yes, no, they weren't well, some papers outside of Lexington published them. The Louisville Defender in Louisville, Kentucky, and I think the Pittsburgh Courier may have carried some articles and some of my photos.
What would they say at the time when you would bring the photographs over, or did you even bother? Did you see it as simply the white paper in town that wasn't going to cover this?
No, I was aware at the time. I was part of the demonstrators, and we were aware they didn't cover it, and we never attempted to show them the photographs or anything. I just photographed them for myself and my friends.
Can you describe the scenes that you photographed?
Mostly people marching down the main street of Lexington, sitting in at the 10-cent stores, prayer vigils in front of the courthouse, and children and ministers participating and women in the movement here. And of James Farmer, and when he would come to speak, who was head of CORE at that time.
And Martin Luther King.
Yes, and Martin Luther King, when we had a big march in Frankfort, Kentucky, the state capital.
You've published now some of these photographs in the paper. Is that right, Linda Blackford?
That's right. We did a whole page of photos. We did photos with the stories, and then we did a whole page of photos, and the response has been overwhelming, to say the least. I think people are stunned to see the sort of vibrancy of the movement that was going on at the time, and it's all thanks to Calvert.
Yeah, a lot of people were unaware that we had a local civil rights movement, I think in part because of the lack of coverage of the Herald Leader.
And what do you think, Calvert McCann, would have happened if the local Maine newspaper, if the Herald Leader, had covered the civil rights movement? Do you think it would have been larger in the town? Do you think more people would have joined?
I think there may have been more people. More people would have joined and maybe, and more interest in the movement. But I really don't think that it may have had that much of an impact because the paper reflected the general opinion, you know, white population in Lexington, the views of the, you know, the population.
Linda Blackford, you write about how, in fact, Lexington, Kentucky was ahead of the curve in the civil rights movement, though you wouldn't know it from the Herald Leader.
That's right. A local UK historian who was doing some research found some old core reports that showed there'd been sit-ins at a restaurant near the University of Kentucky in 1959, which is ahead of the Greensboro, the famous Greensboro sit-ins. But nothing was ever mentioned in the paper, and people basically didn't know anything about it until this professor found it.
What kind of response are you getting around the country to your correction?
It has been really overwhelming. Just emails and you know, phone calls from everywhere, just people really pleased, really interested in this kind of story. It makes me wonder, since I think the majority of Southern newspapers sort of had the same attitude, a lot of Southern newspapers had the same attitude as the Herald Leader. It's interesting that people are just so interested in this kind of thing.
Do you see something similar happening today when it came to the anti-war movement leading up to the invasion? Newspapers and television. I mean, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, CBS, ABC, and PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, of the 393 interviews done around war in a two-week period around Colin Powell's address at the UN. Only three of almost 400 were with anti-war representatives. Do you see some parallels?
I do see some parallels. I mean, I can't speak for the national media, but I know that the people here who are running the newspaper felt like they were doing it in the community's best interest. And I think in interviews that I've heard from representatives of the media, they say they were trying to not be they were trying to be patriotic and trying to support the nation in a time of extreme stress. And I think that's exactly what it was here. But the problem, in my opinion, is that then you're actually kind of controlling the news rather than just covering it.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Linda Blackford, staff writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, and Calvert McCann, retired social worker, took photographs of the Lexington civil rights activism as a high school student. And you can go to our website and we will link to the Lexington Herald Leader, democracynow.org. You can also go there to see the latest of our section to the Rulers Tour tonight at Exit Art in New York City at 7:30, 36 and 10th. Tomorrow at the UNCA Club, UN Correspondents Association, at 1:15, and on Saturday night in Tampa, celebrating community media there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Caduce, Neil Geiser, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.